The tag at the very top, SX Serendip, because people tell me they can't spell serendipity. So South by Serendip, and that's actually a little bit to the story. There's a little bit of story behind that, too. The word serendipity was coined by Horace Walpole and based on the story of the three princes of Serendip. Serendip was an old name for Sri Lanka, and we actually have a Sri Lankan here. We're lucky.
Panel diversity.
Yeah, we got lucky here. And these three princes would wander through the world, getting their experience of what's going on. You know, you go. It's not sowing your wild oats necessarily, but discovering and understanding the world before you get ready to rule. So part of it was the experiencing and the things they would come across, and they were mystery solvers. You know, we were saying like they were Scooby-Doo and the gang in their day and age. So this is a story. But let me go ahead and introduce my panel. All right. So myself, I'm Ron Shaw. I work for IBM as a strategist in social business. So I work certainly on the social networking, social media, and more on the enterprise and what organizations do. Okay. So let's keep going.
I'm Dulisha Kulasuri. I'm with Deloitte Center for the Edge. It's a think tank in Silicon Valley, and we kind of study how the world's changing and how it affects all of us as individuals and institutions.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Okimoto. I'm with IBM also, but I work with our Global Business Services, and I actually work with companies all over the world and across all industries. Feels like I've been doing it for a very long time, introducing what is social before that, Enterprise 2.0 and whatever we're calling it, and helping them figure out how to bring it into their businesses with their customers, partner suppliers, and their employees.
My name is Jim Storer. I'm the founder of the Community Roundtable, and we're a peer network for community managers and social strategists. And what I really try to do is create collisions between our members, you know, through serendipitous events we do and things like that. So I'm really just trying to get folks to connect with one another and find out where there's commonality, where there's needs and wants.
Hey, everybody. Bill Johnston, Director of Global Community at Dell. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been a passionate community builder since the late 90s when I helped launch TechRepublic.com. And I'm really about creating shared spaces, online communities, that create equitable value for both the host organization and the extended stakeholder community. That's my core passion and why I'm here today.
Okay, and actually we'll start back from Bill, coming back this way. And so we know who we are. That's a good thing. What we really want to know is, how did you get here? What led you to this topic? What led you to this idea and this job?
So it's a series of serendipitous experiences. So I actually grew up in Kentucky, and do the time check here, because I'm from Kentucky, I can be a little verbose. So I grew up in Kentucky, and my dad worked in community banking for a while, and then for a technology firm that did data processing for community banks. So at an early age, I saw the impact of a large institution like a bank on the local community, and saw many wonderful things and a few not so wonderful things, but mostly many wonderful things that happen around small communities. And then secondly, my dad plopped an Apple IIc in my bedroom when I was like 5. I had no freaking idea what it could do, but I knew there was something. And so all along, I've been sort of really fascinated with communities, specifically communities as physical spaces and technology. So that's been sort of a key thread throughout my career, starting really with Tech Republic and then with Autodesk for a bit, and now with Dell. So that intersection of technology and community and relationship building.
I'm going to take a slightly different tact. I went to a session yesterday that really inspired me. It was on storytelling. And it was Michael Margolis, and he talked about how critical it is that when we're telling people about where we came from, that it's kind of like a superhero. The superhero didn't come out of the womb a superhero. They have a superhero backstory. And so when you tell your story, you know, you've got to give that backstory. So mine is that I love throwing great parties. And at the core, great parties are about connecting people and, you know, having a good time. And when I think about what I've done in my business life, I've helped organize events. I've built communities, and now I'm doing a community for community managers. So that thread of connecting people and getting them to have fun doing it is really at my core and my core passion.
So my story is I grew up moving around a lot, and I discovered that one way to ease the pain and disruption is finding people in common or people who know people. People have been doing that forever. Because I would focus on others as opposed to my own discomfort, I became intensely interested in people and cultures. And I discovered about 20 years ago that management consulting is a really good way to immerse yourself and meet lots of new people and learn about a lot of new cultures. Because corporate cultures are obviously, as you all know, can be very, very different and fascinating. About 8 years ago, I took time off from work to travel around the world, and I started blogging. And I'm a defunct blogger in case anyone goes out and looks. But I was an early enough blogger to have the domain name jennifer.blogs.com. There's a lot of Jennifers in the world. And but in the course of that, I started watching what people were doing in the blogging space and the communities of people and the cultures of people were coming together and finding each other in this new way. So when I came back to work, I was like, how do we apply that to business? And here I am.
So maybe my journey is a little bit more serendipitous. I grew up in Sri Lanka, and I always thought I knew what I was going to do. Every stage of my life, I always thought I knew what I was going to do, except now. Now I have no idea. I grew up in Sri Lanka, and we had a war going on. So I ended up in the U.S. one way or the other. So I was like, okay, fine. If you grow up, brown, you're expected to become an engineer, so become an engineer. But I didn't do anything with it, so then I left. Decided to do consulting, mainly because I didn't know what else I could do. Did that for many years, went to business school, came back, and I'd basically given notice to quit. And I was going to try my hand at starting a company, doing something else. And one of the partners at Deloitte told me, hey, go check out this new center we started. It's called Center for the Edge, and it seems to be aligned with what you might be interested in. And it was. So I'm here now. I said I'll join you for 6 months, and 3 years later, I'm still there. And it continues to confuse me because I'm seeing a world that's very, very different from what I'd imagined it would be. And it's been many, many serendipitous occurrences, including running into Ron a few years ago, which brings me to this panel here. So I'm still learning how to decipher all this.
Okay. So I'm actually the common, if there's a Venn diagram, I'm the dot in the middle with all these guys. But my story is probably sophomore year in college or so, I got really, really into multiplayer games. And we were talking decades ago. And there were really, yes, there was multiplayer, massive multiplayer games back in the 80s. I think, any one time there were 3,000 people on, anyone remember MUDs?
Yes.
So, yeah, there you go.
Right.
And I spent a lot of time on there. Went through all the levels, all that stuff, but the real fun was actually talking to the people in there. So the social aspect of it, after giving up 2 years of my life, I played once, 72 hours straight. Yeah, we did go to the bathroom. I gave up 2 years of my life, basically, and school, doing that. But I wound up with 3 books on the topic, that was a good outcome. I helped a friend do that. And that was a while back. And then after that, I went more and more into writing. I was a journalist for a while. I had launched some magazines like Java World and Linux World. Then I ended up in IBM for their magazines and ended up becoming the community program manager for DevelopWorks. At that point, it was like 6 million people or so. and more towards the social business side of things, which is what I do now. It's figuring out how does social actually fit into what we do. So all the elements of what, how do people group together, how do people think together, how do people come across each other? So hence the topic, serendipity. And I'll just put a little bit. I met Bill probably 5 or 6 years ago when he was at Forum One, and somebody said, you should go to this Forum One thing. So that was a good discovery there. Jim, I met through Rachel, and says, you should go to this community roundtable thing and talk to those guys. And that was a great thing. Jen, actually, we worked at IBM for a long time together, and I never met her until probably about 2 years ago or so. And so that was we just happened to be at the same conference. Like, oh, that's what she looks like. And Delisha, actually, I met John Hagel, and when he was talking about that, and he's the chairman of the center. And Delisha came by at one of the conferences and said, hey, let's talk a little more about, you know, how do you measure stuff? That was the other thing I did. So that's enough about us. Let's get to the main event itself. And, you know, we'll go through a little bit of the topic itself, but the hashtag in the top there, you can certainly tweet to that hashtag. But, we would certainly appreciate, you know, any questions that you have. Please, the mic over there, you know, they're recording this for a podcast. Just come on up to the mic, and if you see enough people, you know, at least one person, every now and then we'll stop and ask a question. So, very quick definition, and most of this we'll spend discussing amongst ourselves, but we want your input. You know, this is an idea. This is not a hard science. This is formulating, even though it has a very strong place in science through all history. So, a quick definition. It's the accidental discovery that leads to unexpected value. So, I don't know. What do you guys think?
You want me to tell my story from this morning?
Sure.
So, I don't know if you guys noticed, it's Tuesday of South by Southwest, right? Everyone's dragging around. I'm staying at a place off South Congress, so it's about a mile and a half from here. And I'm walking down the street with my friend Derek, and I'm pretty tired, and it's hot out. It's kind of muggy out. I don't know if you noticed that too. But so I'm looking for cabs on South Congress, and I'm losing my mind because they're going past. Excuse me. And I say to Derek, I say, you know what I really want? I want a Chevy to pull up right now. You know, Chevy's driving like they've got 45 cars. They're giving free rides, that sort of thing. Literally. 5 seconds, maybe 10 seconds after I said that, a Chevy, I can see it coming, right? The other direction. I raise my hand. She puts her hand out the window, kind of does one of these things, and we run across the street, hop in, she does a U-turn, she brings us to the hotel. Amazing, right? I mean, that happened to me, similar story from last year with Chevy. So they're starting to develop a track record with this cars driving around South by Southwest thing. And I don't know about you, but that's a really fascinating, you know, use of innovative brand marketing. And I don't know if it's going to get me to buy a Chevy, but I'm going to tell the story, and it's going to lift their brand with a lot of different people, I think. So that's my story from today.
So let's ask, you know, South by, this happens all the time. Who's had a serendipitous event, you know, show of hands, at South by? Whoa.
It's got to be like, who hasn't at this point?
Okay. Yeah. Hold on, keep your hands up. Let's see. All right, who wants to share their story? Just keep your hand up if you want to.
I want Adam to share his.
Okay.
Go to the mic, please.
Yeah, if
please
you can.
Please go to the mic, Adam.
It's right behind you there. Yeah, great. And anyone else, just if you want to share your story, just come on up. Go ahead.
Sure. This is a good one. So I was actually attending the community roundtable event a couple of days ago. I'll just crash down low. The event was for the launch of Barclays Card, new community credit card situation. And I walked in the door. You know, I've known Jim for several years, and my agency is working a lot with the community roundtable. And I walked in, and the product manager for Barclays Card was a friend of mine from high school. Just had no idea. Had no idea he was going to be at South by. Had no idea that that's what he did for a living. Haven't seen him in more than 20 years, and just walked over. And you know, you talk about Jim wanting to throw a good party. He actually throws a good party of bringing together a lot of people with the similar passions and interests, and you end up finding a lot of overlap of common interests. So, thank you, Jim, for creating nice. That story for me.
Well, thanks. I'm sure somebody else has one. Come on. Oh, sure.
Hi, I'm Adam. We went to a party, like our team went to a party last night. It was kind of a VIP deal, and they were completely underwhelmed. They had staffed and paid drink minimums on like 150 people, and there were 30 people there. So that was pretty serendipitous for us. We kind of stayed, kind of just stayed all night and drank until the bar shut down. So that was fun. I'm dying.
But so, I mean, just if I may, just a quick question, and I kind of know the answer to this already, but
How many of you feel like the core value of South By is in the panel? I mean, not to blow our credibility as a panel, but is the value in the panels or in the conversations that happen in the halls and after the panels? So panels, hands up.
Hands up for panels.
Thank you for being honest. And everything else, right? Cool. And I'll talk about open space a little bit in a minute, but I believe that as well. Although I think we're having a fabulous time right now.
So I was looking down, so I missed that. How many people do you think? What percentage?
This is like 90.
90%?
Yeah.
In the panels?
No. Outside of the panels. Okay. Outside of the panels. Outside of the panels.
Trying to do multiple things here. So I want to get back to the point of the definition. So accidental discovery. Accidental discovery has played a huge role in humanity. So think of penicillin. Yeah. Alexander Fleming, his discovery of penicillin was just basically left the culture overnight and found that it was killing, I think, what was it, smallpox? Smallpox. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, that led to many, many, many millions of lives. I mean, that's the prototypical example. But here's a few others. Wilhelm Röntgen discovered x-rays. Again, serendipity. He just, you know, a lot of these things, like, we just left something running and we found out the next day this has got this amazing scientific properties. Roy Plunkett, Teflon. He was looking for a new type of refrigerator gas. And now it's saving us everywhere from destroying pans and kitchens everywhere. The evidence for the Big Bang. Now, that sets where we are in the world, you know, our sense of what the universe is like, that there was a Big Bang. This was actually the cosmic background radiation. You know, what they discovered was the white noise, the Bell Lab scientists, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. And they were just working on satellite communications, and they had a listening device, and they found this hum constantly going, and they kept turning the satellite, the listener, and they kept turning it. No matter which way, there was always this hum. And there was just this, like, they did everything they possibly could. And then eventually, you know, when they published it, it's like, wow, we found this tone, which is remaining tone, just that exists in the universe. And it's been proven many times. So those are some of the examples of accidental discovery. But, you know, those are scientific examples. And, you know, that's the coming to the second point of what we have here, you know, innovation. So I'm going to turn to the panel. What do you think of innovation? How does it relate to serendipity?
Well, I mean, innovation is a very big topic. We all know about it. It's a creation of a new product, a process, a service. But it differs from invention that it has to be accepted by society. But where this starts tying in with our topic on serendipity is that while serendipity feels like luck, and a lot of the examples you gave may feel like luck, I think our theory is that you can harness serendipity. You can do things to increase your chances for serendipity. So you can increase that potential for more lucky situations to happen. And then that's kind of my point of view on this, and that's what we believe. There are things you can do in the physical space, there are things you can do in the virtual space to increase serendipity.
Okay, well, we'll get to the examples, but what do you think?
You're looking at
Jen, it's
oh, that's my that's
this
my
whole
cue.
Direction.
Well, I agree. I think there is around the intersection between innovation and serendipity in the world I work on. It's whether you use technologies or you bring people together. And I talk about using facilitated creativity because a lot of times bringing people together and getting them to think in new ways to be innovative is my perspective that a lot of times that's been pounded out of individuals. Mm-hmm. We've taught people not to be creative, not to be curious, not to take risks, especially in certain corporate environments, in certain cultures. And so can you bring people together and intentionally create something where ultimately you get a bit of serendipity? I also believe that empathy is part of that, where they come together and start to see things in some interesting ways. And ultimately create something of value.
Okay. Actually, I had a question there. Is do you think serendipity has to be social?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it takes more than one party, right? It's as a specific example, I am working on a redesign of IdeaStorm, Dell IdeaStorm. And one of the key things that we found when we took this, my team took the site over, was there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the ideation process, because you would send an idea to Dell, it would sort of wander around in the, you know, inside of Dell, and you may or may not hear a response back. And so I looked to a lot of books and articles for inspiration for what to do next, and obviously a lot of conversations with colleagues in the industry. And one of my favorite books was Stephen Johnson's book around the history of ideation and innovation. And one of the key things I took away was that, you know, ideas don't happen in a vacuum, and innovation doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's a network, right? It's a network that makes it happen. And further, I think that, you know, the context for serendipity to happen, and keep in mind, the caveat here is I'm the online community guy, right? But it's a network. And so I like to think about, you know, the entire network and all the latent value in the network, and serendipity is one of those techniques that we can use or try to harness to surface as much of that value as possible in a collaborative fashion. So I absolutely believe, you know, it takes a village, it takes a network.
It has to be sort of. Can I?
Yeah.
So one of the guys I work with is John Seely Brown. He used to head Xerox PARC many years ago when all these inventions came out. So when he first started Xerox PARC, the issue they had was they had all these really smart research people, but they were like geeks and nerds, and they would be in their own communities just studying this, the one thing that they really knew. And they weren't connecting with each other, which is one of those things where you kind of capture the latent capacity in that network. So they did a couple of things to change that. They subsidized the food in the cafeteria quite a bit. So there's no incentive to go out and buy food, nor was any incentive to bring food. So people didn't go downstairs to the cafeteria to eat. Then they took out all the tables that are like the 2x2, the small tables with four people sitting around, and installed big, long tables, like the picnic tables, 20 people to a table kind of thing. And that completely changed the environment, because when you're sitting at a long table with these other people and there's a conversation going on next to you, it gives you permission to jump into that conversation. And they suddenly started seeing a lot more sparks flying, a lot more people connecting. It's the same thing like what happens in South By when you're like standing in line and you hear a conversation, you have permission to jump into that conversation. So that's a great example of like a way to harness serendipity. So Steve Jobs was one of the people who went through one of the many people who went through Xerox PARC, and he kind of took this to heart. So when he designs a lot of the spaces that people work in, he's very particular about all this stuff. So when he designed Pixar, the building, he not only made sure the cafeteria was in the middle of the whole complex, he made sure all the restrooms are in the middle of the complex. So you had to walk the halls. And a lot more people are connecting just by walking the halls. So it is inherently social by that example, at least.
Mm-hmm. And inconvenient, too.
Yep.
Sometimes inconvenient.
You know, so this is actually an example, you know, serendipity itself. We talked about two different things. We talked about it in terms of technology. We talked about it in terms of physical spaces. And actually, the uncomfortableness of it, getting out of your comfort zone, may have something to do with it. Mm. You know, if it's that you have to walk the length to get to the bathroom, mm-hmm. So you might have the most conversations on the way back. Maybe not on the way there.
Well, I think that's a huge part of serendipity and trying to change your culture. When we work with companies and a lot of the companies that are members of the Community Roundtable, we always hear that culture change is the biggest challenge that organizations face in becoming more social and using some of these technologies. And I think by doing the table or changing the way you lay out your buildings can really start to shape the way people think about the way they communicate. They become less controlling of information, and they become more willing to share. And I think that can really help organizations shift and start to become much more ready to adopt social technologies.
Yeah, we've got a question. Come on.
Yeah, just a question on that point. We're talking about physical spaces here, but what about virtual spaces? Where's the virtual bathroom or virtual cafeteria?
Yeah.
Well, I'll take it first. There's a lot that you can do there. I mean, I think in creating communities, there's a lot about facilitation, and I'll be the first to tell you that I think community managers, and it's near and dear to my heart, but and it's important for what I do, but I think community managers are one of the most underrepresented at the executive levels of organizations. They can really impact the way organizations, how successful organizations are with these technologies. So facilitation is critical, and I want to let Bill follow up because it's creating collisions between members, between employees. So in online spaces, that can take you can have sessions that run every week. I like the concept of office hours. So if you've got executives that have them do online office hours and have them be available or, you know, during that time frame for folks to chat with them, interact with them. Bill, go.
A couple of examples from Dell. So we have a social media certification program. Amy Tennyson, who's actually in the room, developed large chunks of it and deserves a lot of credit. We have this awesome social media certification program, and as a sort of as a point of punctuation for getting for graduating through that program, we often hold unconferences for the folks that are coming out of certification. So we've done this globally, and an unconference is essentially I don't know if many of you have been to a bar camp or an open space event, but it's essentially participant-driven conference experience, and it's awesome. So we use unconference as a way to, one, put together employees and departments that normally never talk to each other, so it's a forced juxtaposition. And number two, we use the format to surface topics that allow for those people within departments who are normally sort of segregated to come together to have discussions around issues they're facing, things they don't understand, things that we could improve on. So we've had, you know, all kinds of interesting initiatives spring out of unconference, including our sponsorship of South By this year, as a matter of fact, because a ton of people came together and were like, we're in Austin, like, why aren't we doing more with South By? So unconference is one, and that's physical, but that also leads to online conversations. And then we use Chatter internally to have internal conversations that are, at least at this time, not very well facilitated. But we do have Chatter groups within the org that most anyone can join around topics. So at least we're attracting people by topic, and there's a conversation flow. Can we do a better job of it in the virtual space? Of course. I think everybody could. I think we're just getting to things in the industry like talent identification, subject matter expertise surfacing within organizations, and facilitating conversations on a more regular basis virtually. But you know, that's what we're working on. That's what I'm actively working on now. So it's a problem and an opportunity, but those are two things that we're doing at Dell.
Okay. Oh yeah, Jen had actually.
Yeah. So I tend to work with organizations that let's say they want.
Somebody had a hand up. I'm sorry. Actually, could you bring it up to?
We say in the design center, we design despite our space. I mean, they're now finally redesigning the design center, but I think part of that is really key, is having that space where you can get together. And you see it all the time. Like, we started tearing down our own walls in Parmer, you know, just tearing down the cube walls. And you're starting to see that happen, ripple effect. Like, in another building, they started doing it. And then now I see it happening. I'm over in Enterprise now, and you see that happening in Five. And you can see that it's taken hold. It's just like people kind of like said, wait a minute, this isn't working. Let's make it work for us. And so that's kind of a serendipitous moment. There was a moment where a whole bunch of people brought in these IKEA leaves and put them up to try to block some of the light. And they got in trouble. And then that started a whole nother conversation. So I think that, you know, the community is working. That movement is working. So it's kind of interesting, like just taking it one step further from a person in the trenches kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Thank you.
Did you tell your Babson story about the transparency?
Oh, yeah. One more.
Sorry,
on physical spaces. I got an MBA at Babson, and they just built the new building when I went there. And the way they designed it, it was atrium based, and the cafeteria was on the first floor, and all of the offices and spaces that were within the internal atrium were glass walled. So you had complete visibility into who was where and what was going on. And the couches that were along, you know, there were little couch pods on the different floors that encouraged you to, you know, kind of plop down next to someone and start a conversation. It was, you know, that sort of design and really, really helps to create those collisions that, that are important for serendipity.
Yeah, Jen had something.
So I work with companies who want to do the same thing, but they have people who've never met each other, and they're in different countries and different time zones. And they want to create that same environment. And one of my perspectives is it's not either or. We tend to swing in our way we design things and structure things and budget things. So I do a lot of facilitated workshops where often also very controlling organizations, very culturally stiff organizations, and they'll say, well, we'll bring all our managers in to design this new approach. And I am very insistent on having great diversity in the room as you actually create these new ways of work. And when I say diversity, I'll say that doesn't just mean age, because it's not just an age issue. There's a location-based diversity. There's tenure-based diversity. There's all sorts of different, background and education.
Crankiness-based diversity.
Crankiness. Well, that's, Ron, that's a great, I always, my folks tell me, I always make sure there's at least one or two Ralphs. And Ralph is the cranky person who is going to say, you're just talking about bringing Facebook to the company, and I don't understand. It's a waste of time. And Ralph is often a thought leader, someone who's very passionate about the company, has given a lot of his or her life, and wants to leave a legacy. And kind of the intentional serendipity is, by the end, often Ralph is one of the advocates of the new way of working, because all of a sudden he realizes there's great possibility that he can get his head around. And so I think it's thinking about physical spaces, digital spaces, diversity of people to create things in the context of whatever the business or organization is trying to accomplish.
Actually, I wanted to make a point and ask a question, which was, when you said earlier, I asked, it doesn't need to be social. What do you think? I mean, is finding something just randomly going through a website, just you and websites, is that serendipity? There, come on up.
Hi there. My name is Ari Lightman. I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. I just have a quick question. We do a lot of research on this idea of propinquity, which is the physical interaction between people. And the closer that you have, the more chance that you have for serendipitous events to occur. I work in the virtual space. So I teach a class on measuring social. So we look at community analysis. We also look at crowdsourcing initiatives. Mm-hmm. And I always have this debate with my colleagues. And one of the big things we're interested in is, can, if you have a completely virtual organization, can you recreate that idea of propinquity in a virtual manner? I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
I think there are ways you can replicate it in the same way as having that random conversation, and you could by having just news feeds and paying attention to it, but it doesn't work as well. So one of the things we've found particularly that works well in these communities is allowing people to talk about their passions, to put their passions out in some way, and that happens in one of two ways. One, you put it out as a statement, and this is what I care about, this is what I'm passionate about, but another way is just by looking at the post, whatever they post up there, that people start building their reputations for being good or being known for one thing or the other. And that allows for others to connect to you. So I see this in Facebook. I know who my foodie friends are in Facebook. And everyone knows who they are in your own, like, you know, because they keep posting about that stuff. So if there's a connection that came up and someone asked a question, you know who to point that question out to. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's one of the ways that you can increase it. So you want to give them the space to present their passions, and then I think connections start happen.
But there's also another point in there, which is memory, the context. You're remembering what, who was, said what, and what they were doing there. You think?
Yeah. So, both myself and Jim have managed hybrid networks of, where there's a physical dimension and an online dimension. So I'm not going to, the caveat is I won't fully answer your question, but I'll do my best. What I've seen is when you can get parts of the network together, specifically the advocates or the most active or elites, it tends to accelerate and build deeper connective tissue with the community than just solely virtual, which may sound like a patently obvious thing to say, but it's true. I don't know what your experience has been with the roundtable, but that was my experience at Forum One.
Well, I'll give you another example from South By. There's a site called FAWM.org, F-A-W-M.org, and it, you know about it?
Great.
Well, maybe we'll have you tell about it. It stands for February Album Writing Month, and it's a guy who got seven of his friends or six of his friends together to start writing 14 songs in 28 days. In February, obviously, and the idea was to collaborate and, you know, to put your ideas out there and connect with people that you otherwise wouldn't know about. And so, you know, I think that's a great example of what you're talking about. And one of the keys of, I think, of what they've done there is it's all about the constraint of 14 songs in 28 days. And so part of what I do with the roundtable is introduce constraints in interactions that we do. So it might be topic-based. It could be time-based. But I think constraints are a really important part of getting people to connect with one another.
Yeah, we have a question. Why don't you go ahead?
Jim, you might have actually just answered it. But in terms of serendipity online, and you guys started to talk about, you know, when you're on your own, cruising websites, seeing new ideas, at least personally, I feel like there's almost too much serendipity where you start to get numb to it because you're exposed to so many things and you kind of keep seeking out so many new things that you stop identifying those opportunities to actually discover something new or make an intersection and create something new. So I guess, you know, what strategies would you guys recommend in terms of maybe constraints or process that helps you kind of stop and smell the roses, if you will, and, you know, use these wonderful ideas you're being exposed to actually then and go do something and not be keep bombarding yourself with, you know, all these moments.
So the possibility of getting serendipped out?
Yeah, no, that's a great question.
Yeah, stream overload?
Ron, you want to take
it? Yeah, actually, it's one of those things. It's you need that spare time, wherever it is, whether it's work and you're doing it, whether you're doing it by just, you know, in browsing the web and finding the information. You need process time, downtime, where it actually your brain starts to relax some so it can actually work by itself. There's unconscious thinking involved in that, unconscious development of that idea. You know, personally, I wake up in the morning sometimes like, oh my goodness, I have this great idea. I have to go write it down. And it was just something that I was thinking about 2 days ago. And I had that long sleep, thankfully restful, you know, without my kids screaming. That allowed that to happen. The other one is like I get good ideas when I'm just driving, you know, just driving to work, driving to Starbucks, wherever it is. You know, you have to have peaceful time. I don't turn on the music. I actually don't listen to the radio in the car very much because it gives me that moment of peace and clarity to actually, like, you know, dive into the problem itself. I mean, I'll just jump in here.
Jonah Lehrer just came out with he's coming out with a new book about creativity. And he just came out in an article, I think today, in the Wall Street Journal, talking about that. And he said alcohol helps, which makes a lot of sense for South By, because it basically slows down your processing speed and allows you to think more like a kid, and it brings down those boundaries.
For me, it's an information literacy question in a way. Mark Hurst wrote this great book a few years ago called Bit Literacy, which I wish he would update because so much has happened in social. But it's basically controlling streams and having appropriate filters and having sort of your own built-in expert network or your own, you know, your own panel of friends to bounce things off of. But I do agree as well. So it's information literacy. It's controlling as best you can what you're consuming, which I know it sounds counterintuitive. And then lastly, it's just having that rest, that downtime to process.
Well, I think anything that'll allow you to create stocks of the information that's flowing by.
Right.
I mean, for me, it's that little read later tab that I've got for Instapaper. That's a complete time saver for me. I mean, I've got these streams of content flowing by, and instead of being interrupted every 5 or 10 minutes, I just hit read later, and then I you know, that's when I sit up late at night. I just sit up and read those. So,
okay. So we'll take one question, and then we'll get back to the Johnny Cash thing. So okay. Go ahead.
Hey, so I'm curious, when you're looking at a digital serendipitous environment, you're probably spending a lot of time both on, like, the people side, getting people to engage on the platform, but then also technically how to improve the platform, if that's, you know, leveraging the API and doing a couple other, you know, whatever enhancements you can. And I'm curious what's the split between your, like, your time and your resources and your energy into, like, trying to get the
moving the people versus trying to improve the actual platform or the tool, the product.
I'm interested to hear what the other panelists say. I spend very little time on the technology because it can really hinder. But what you can do is if you get people to share about themselves in a way that's searchable, then they're going to start finding connections amongst them. And I do this whole matchmaker thing, and the way I'm able to pull it off is by getting people to share about themselves. And so we do a lot in profiles so that within profiles there's keyword tagging so that people are tagging themselves. My community manager does a lot of that as well. So where we do a welcome interview with everyone, and then from that we generate tags that we can put on individuals, and it helps us with that matching. Some of it happens through heavy lifting that we do, but a lot of it happens right in the platform. And yeah, Bill, what do you think about technology?
Gosh, I've got some things to say about this. So I've been at Dell for 2 years. The first 9 months, I was working on our platform because it was in some ways fundamentally broken, and I couldn't wait to be done with it. Once I got the features that I wanted, it was platform, programs, and people. So it was getting to what's the right staffing based upon our communities, and then what are the programs that will engage and that will surface things of both value to Dell and value to the community. So my ideal split is 10% platform, so maintenance, understanding if we have the right APIs out and in, if we're connected to the right external social networks, but it's 90% of the time on making sure we have the right people managing the community, engaged in the community, and making sure we have the right programs, like our advocacy programs, our reputation management programs, content programs, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Come on up. Yeah.
I feel like I should wrap. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Awesome. So I've made quite a few notes. This has been really great. And one of the things that I think is really key to the panels for me is coming away with sort of a language to navigate, right, all of the ideas, right? Everything that we're hearing, everything that we're seeing that we think is interesting that we tab for read later. And we say, wow, that's great. I want to learn more about that. And I'm wondering, as you guys, and I think this question really is more for Dell and IBM, as you guys are ultimately businesses, right? You have products you need to sell. You have brands that you need to keep strong and continue to develop. How much of this do you see yourself sharing with your customer base, right? Whether it's through some like about us or some kind of corporate responsibility initiative, because you also need to bring the marketplace with you, right? You have to have your customers ready to accept the manifestation of all of this innovation and all of this internal serendipity that you're trying to facilitate. Did that make sense?
Jen, you want to take that?
Sure. We do a lot of different things. From a brand perspective, IBM has made a decision. It doesn't make sense for a lot of brands, but the brand of IBM is based on the relationships with IBMers. So I believe Susan Emmerich's in the room, and she's actually creating a whole new way to help IBMers interact with people who have, they're not in the social space at all. They're deep technologists, they're scientists, they're industry leaders, whatever. Reach out and touch, and communicate and engage with both the public and our customer base. Because it's both, right? The other thing we do, and I've been personally involved in this, is we have something a little bit like the Peace Corps for corporate responsibility, and IBMers go around the world. And I've had the great opportunity to spend time on, because my hat is social, the role of citizen engagement and behavior change with cities. So I've spent time in Australia, I've spent time in France, I've spent time in Poland. And we do kind of both help solve problems as well as create environments where we create innovative new ideas with groups of people who probably, I want to be careful about how I say this, but wouldn't pay, can't afford IBM to walk in and do it as a paid engagement. But it gets them thinking about the future of this because we create technologies that help cities and companies.
But what's the serendipity aspect there?
Bringing different groups of people from different disciplines, focused on something outside of their job, gives them space to think about things in new ways and new ideas. I spent 3 weeks in Australia working on one of these projects, and one of my colleagues who was there with us, 33-year-old IBM or 33-year IBMer, not 33 years old, and he was like, he'd never done something like that. It changed his mindset about what was possible, let alone what it did with the group of folks who were so amazing that we were working with, which was pretty much everyone in the whole town, it felt like. But there's lots of different ways that are just different than the typical business, going to market, pumping out products, selling things, whatever.
That's great.
Cool. So my answer in two parts. One is the grossly general, and then last is the specific. So generally speaking, we're trying to do something very similar where we, you know, the intersection of Dell internal stakeholders and our external stakeholders, including customers, we're trying to connect as often and as at scale as possible globally. So via our online communities, via things like IdeaStorm, we're trying to make that connection. So we're certifying our folks internally so that they feel comfortable and understand boundaries. We're trying to reach out through various and sundry social channels. Specifically where the intersection happens and where serendipity and innovation happen are in places like our Dell Tech Center community for public and large enterprise, where IT pros, IT admins are coming together to have weekly chats and weekly interactions around our latest products, to understand how to use them, to understand how to master them. It's well beyond, customer support. The other thing is IdeaStorm. So IdeaStorm is this massive social suggestion box where you can give feedback to Dell and make suggestions to Dell on anything. So that was interesting and useful in 2007, but we're trying to make it even more interesting and useful now. So we're working on a redesign which launches in 2 weeks that really gets at trying to make ideation more cyclical and involve more stakeholders in the process of a singular idea. So it evolves over time as opposed to being the static thing that sort of sits out in the community. The second thing we do is something called storm sessions, where we have a time and topic bound conversation around specific issues. So we just finished a series with the Environmental Defense Fund around power, right? So all aspects of energy. But the storm sessions can range from sustainability to specific things like what should be in the unboxing experience of the latest Alienware laptop, right? So those things, they're bounded and they're serendipitous because we're bringing the community together in a very specific way for a very specific time to talk about a very specific topic. Happy to chat later about anything
that's great.
Else.
Thank you.
Cool. And actually, it's curious that you said that. So I worked on a study on collective intelligence. And collective intelligence is ways of how people can work together. And the point of that was to look at what are the different models. So the IdeaStorm model, the virtual dialogue ideation model, that's one. That's actually used in several different forms. This one is actually another one. And we'll play just a little bit for folks who didn't see it in the beginning. Where's the audio? Oh, maybe it's just starting up.
No idea.
No. You want to sing, so give us some overlay?
Ain't no grave gonna hold my body down. Ain't no grave gonna hold my body down.
Best panel ever. Okay, we got everybody. Let's sing this uplifting Johnny Cash song.
So one of the things to notice here, it's obviously a dedication to Johnny Cash. It was a project put together to do several things. There's always this music video already existed, the original one, not the one that you're seeing up on screen. what you see is actually there's several different things. Every single one of this is a piece of art. So what they did was they broke up this thing, the video, into many different frames. And you could take that frame, go to the website, thejohnnycashproject.com, and you could paint up the frame and submit that frame, whatever it is. And there will every single frame, you can see a whole stream of them. So there are several different things here. You can have individual works of art come out. So you could discover a new artist this way. Someone who made a really good single-frame picture. Another one is actually just stringing together all these things into the overall music video itself. So a conceptualist might have a theme that they might want to come out of all of this. And they didn't create the video, the art themselves. They didn't create the video themselves, but they created something new, the stream that came out of it, their inspiration that comes out of the whole thing. So the obviously, you know, the last ending slide is the dedication itself, but you can watch this thing in so many different ways, inspire you in so many different ways. The serendipity here, the innovation is, I think it's obvious. It's a whole new way of looking at art and music. While doing one of my favorite subjects, collective intelligence, having people produce this. And they're fans, they're artists. You know, some are commercially motivated, some are just, you know, real fans. Others are just, hey, I'm just going to try and play with this picture. You know, it's simple drawing things. So, and the serendipity is, again, how do you bring these things together? And the nice idea of this is going to bring up my next question. Is technology a requirement for serendipity? Why not, Delisha?
No, because we all talked about the physical space and where we could have kind of serendipitous meetings, and it doesn't have to be a technology. I think technology enhances serendipity. So one of the big topics this year with South By is around location-based services, ambient services. Did any of you guys see the Amber Case talk? I mean, that was pretty impressive on what can happen, right? So a few years ago, I mean, Tom Friedman wrote the book, The World is Flat, and we talk about you could be anywhere in the world and you could connect with anyone, and that's great. Richard Florida, who's another thinker on this topic, wrote a piece on Atlantic talking about the world is spiky, that these spikes are becoming more and more important. And so those physical spaces, the cities, and that's why if you want to do something in tech, you need to be in San Francisco or Austin. You don't need to be, but if you're in those spaces, the likelihood of serendipitous occurrence are going to be much more. So you get these spikes, right? And the spikes exist in cities. The spikes exist in cities where there's a congregation, and spikes exist in a convention like South By. So people who have similar interests come together, and that increases the chance you're going to meet or talk to someone who has an adjacent idea. So think about this. With those ambient technologies, cities and these spikes become more and more important, because now if I walk, it's fine to have all these ambient technologies, but if I'm living in middle of nowhere, I can't use it. There's no one around, like it doesn't get it shown up, right? But if I'm in New York, if I'm in San Francisco, and then it'll be lighting up all over the place. So I think technology is becoming more and more important. But you can have serendipity without technology.
Can I answer the question by asking a question?
Yeah.
So our audience talked about, you raised your hands around serendipity that happened here at South By. First, how many of you did download and use like Highlight or Banjo or something like that? Just raise them high. How many of you would attribute, keep your hand up, if you'd attribute using one of those applications for the serendipity you talked about earlier?
Oh, come on.
So one? Maybe one.
Maybe wow. One.
Maybe
come on,
one.
Come on, at least stand up. Yeah.
So I'm answering it by saying earlier we had, you know, probably 75% of the room said they'd experienced serendipity, yet maybe 1% of the room said that serendipity happened because of technology. So
there's actually two points I wanted to bring up here per what he said. So by coincidence, I gave a talk at the California Agricultural Summit. Where's food going? Where's population going? How much is California producing? You know, things of that nature. So one of them was basically Professor Emeritus, and I wrote this up on my first blog. The United Nations projects that we have 7 billion now, 7 billion people in the world. We'll have 8 billion people by about 2024. We'll have 9 billion by 2050. It's not, you know, geometrically, it's actually sort of just even tapering down a little. But 9 billion people. But that's not the interesting thing. 49% live in cities now. By 2050, almost 80% will be in a city. Yeah. So if you think of every single person in the world now, 6 billion people will be living in cities. That's twice as much as average. You know, regardless what city you live in, there'll be every two people for every one person you see. I was born in Bangladesh. There's a heck of a lot of people in Bangladesh. It's the size of the state of Arizona, and it's got 150 million people. That's half the population of the U.S. Yeah, you can't spit in Bangladesh because you'll spit on someone. But the reality is that this is a good sign. What Delisha just said is that now it also there's a positive side to this. Now the chances of better things happening, innovative ideas happening, will come out more because of that density. Yes, density causes all sorts of other problems, but there's a good side to it. Now, I want to bring up the other point, which was what my friend Stowe Boy did. There was another session called The Connected Company, and Stowe coins this words like he likes to, and he called it co-indensity. Co-indensity. So does serendipity just happen because of density? Is it going to naturally happen?
No. Actually, and I think, is this Rachel?
It is.
Yeah. Rachel asked a question that from an organizational perspective. As important as I think cities are, in corporations and government organizations that have a culture of control, one of the issues around trust. So you can have density and you can have a large organization, but if people don't trust each other, they don't sit down and start chatting. They don't share their information. They don't do these things. And so I think there's a whole aspect around trust and corporate culture that is, even though you may have large numbers of people, you need to create an environment where there is a comfort and a literacy and I call it the muscles and the attitude that's willing to engage.
Well, and you need to get them to that aha moment, right? You were talking about how
is another example.
How you use the jams to kind of change the culture and get people to that aha moment where technology and social technology in particular really, they see how it can really impact their life and their work and how they're successful.
Right. And jams are like an event-based experience that IBM's been doing for a while, and we actually think it's helped us when we went into enterprise platforms. It helped enhance or accelerate people jumping in and using this stuff because we had started to create a culture of that we expect people to join in and have transparent conversations with people they don't know for an event on innovation, on values. And now we do it with clients. There's one kicking off right now on security that's being sponsored by like NATO or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just this has come up a couple of times, but just that, especially for the enterprise, that sort of more open space or jam type session is literally like in-person social media, right? So if you model it out and get people comfortable in the physical sense, then it's much more likely to happen in the virtual sense.
And actually, Jim was telling me this earlier. They are actually a way of changing your culture as well. Mm-hmm. You do this thing, so you force people into a public space where they are all involved there, and by doing so, they are actually, you're changing the culture to be more public. They find it more okay. It's okay to do this.
Yeah.
So I know we have a go ahead.
We have to build new practices. These things didn't exist before because the technology didn't exist before. But as human beings, I mean, Ray Kurzweil talks about this a lot, right? We adopt these new technologies very quickly, and we'll build new practices around it as they become available.
So we have several questions. Yeah. So go ahead first, and then I'll take an online one.
Hi, it's Tyson at Goodrich on Twitter. I work for an agency in Boston, and I'm sort of following up Rachel's question with how do you make it happen at large organizations? And all three of our clients are in financial services, healthcare, and higher ed. So, and I went to Engler's talk yesterday. I'm wondering if you guys have any comments or advice to spur serendipity in those type of organizations. It's proving a challenge to me, but welcome any and all insight.
There's not one answer, but hitting across lots of different areas. I've spent 5 years working with an organization that has an intention to be more collaborative and more innovative and more social with its customers and its employees, and they hired me to come in and work with their managers. Their leaders got it. Their employees got it. But often, so I heard someone refer to it the other day as there's the clay in the middle that everything gets stuck,
right.
And really working to help them because, I mean, this isn't their fault. I mean, people are busy. People are tapped. They've got little space and time. And it's new, and it's threatening and scary, and helping. I mean, I create experiences where they have safe environments to learn, what this means, how to apply it to their relationships with their employees, the way their teams work together, how they do, you know, goal setting and performance management and feedback and coaching. I mean, and you start to change the culture of how you do the business of management, how you do the business of how you work together.
The number one thing that members of our network talk about is that you need to evangelize internally. It's not really in their job description, but over and over again they come back and they say, we spent so much time just talking about how it can benefit. And again, it's trying to get folks internally to see that kind of aha moment happen.
So, let's take the question. Adam Cohen, I know you have almost the exact same question, so almost. Okay. So, yeah, we have 2 minutes left, so let's go ahead and take this question.
I'll try and make it quick. Sure. So I work for a local software company here in town called Bizarre Voice. I work in a part of the organization called the Center of Excellence, which we just spun up. And one of the things that my team is considering is starting a residency program where we take subject matter experts out of production or whatever they're doing and try to build some of those connections. Do you have any suggestions or any experiences doing something like this to create those really rich experiences? So if someone is spending a month of their lives trying to step out of their day-to-day work to solve bigger business problems internally, how do you make that a really effective experience?
So Dell has a couple of examples. We actually have a marketing rotation program. Sarah, are you here? Raise your hand, Sarah. So Sarah's actually in rotation now. She's going to France soon. So, I mean, there's just the basic rotation programs. I've often thought it would be really interesting to have partner rotation programs. So say we swap people at Dell and Bizarre Voice and talk about forced juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. I mean, how awesome would that be? But have, you know, trusted partners where, like, there's a social slot and there's maybe a change management slot, and you just rotate between five companies over, you know, X number of months. I think that would be super interesting. Mm-hmm. Jen, are you guys doing anything at IBM?
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that's my next job. we do it at the corporate services core. We have something called the Smarter City Challenge, mm-hmm. where cities propose. They make proposals to IBM that says, this is the problem we want to work on, and IBM sends people through our foundation to go work on it. But hopefully, I don't want to jinx anything, but we also do that at our executive levels, too. We do it at lots of, you know, it has to be based on something that's real. It has to be problems that are hard to solve. And there, I mean, Jim said something very important, and there has to be some facilitation and some constraints to actually result in something tangible. Yeah.